Hello and welcome to the Tech and Trees podcast. My name is Pascal Mies, and on Tech and Trees, I talk to climate tech startup founders, operators, and investors about how we build better climate tech and how we build more of it faster. This time, I spoke to Timur Sirman, co-founder of Magnotherm. Magnotherm is a German company that developed a magnetic cooling technology that is vastly more energy efficient and environmentally friendly than fluid-based cooling systems. By bringing this cooling technology to, for example, supermarkets, Magnotherm plans to cut the energy usage and emission intensity of cooling. I spoke to Timur about his sales process, dealing with customers, and fundraising. So sit back, listen, and learn about Magnotherm from Timur Sirman. Timur, it's so nice to have you. Thank you so much for taking the time. How are you doing today?
Pretty good, pretty good. Trying to survive currently in the current wave of the flu, but other than that, I'm very happy. Actually, tonight is the Christmas party of our company, so I'm really looking forward to this.
Okay, bracing yourself for festivities. I see. I would say we dive right in, and I would like to know, you already mentioned your company, but I think it's easy to forget that, you know, people are people outside of work as well, right? So I'd like to know from you, like, what defines your identity aside from being the co-founder of Magnotherm?
It's a very interesting question, because when you walk through life as a startup founder, you're always very, let's say, attached to what you do. So that's basically the topic also in, let's say, private circles like family or friends. But aside from that, I think what identifies me is really being amongst friends and family. I'm a very social person, so I love to visit people or have people visiting me and hang out with them and go out for a nice cocktail or for a nice meal or dinner. So that's basically aside from doing sports as well. So I love to run. So my wife and I have recently done the Berlin Marathon, for example. So that's where I try to get some balance from the daily work life.
So definitely someone who draws energy from interacting with others.
Absolutely.
Yeah, cool. What's like the last aha moment that you have had? And that can be, you know, a private one in terms of like something personal, or it can be entirely work related.
To be honest, my last aha moment was recently realizing that we have built already quite a good company with Magnotherm. Going from, all right, this is on the right path, to, okay, we're actually on a quite good path already, and building confidence from this. So yeah. That really helped me recently also to grow as a person, to be honest. Before that, I was a little bit more insecure, I would say.
Okay. Well, that's a very good insight, actually. Like, I mean, like, if you're able to build confidence from such an ammo, that's amazing. And like, as you mentioned, Magnotherm, I think it might answer the next question that I have for you. But if you look at the world, what's a ridiculous problem that you would like to see solved?
Well, coming from Germany, that's a very controversial topic, because everyone knows the Autobahn. For me, it's such a simple problem to solve. Why you would not limit the speed limit to 120 or 130 kilometers an hour. It's so easy to do, and it saves so many emissions with a finger snap. So that's ridiculous to me, and I don't understand why there's so much lobbyism involved with the German car manufacturers and so on. But yeah.
I see you're a friend of the quick wins. No, but I can relate to that for sure. Let's get talking about what you're doing. And I mean, we've mentioned the company now a little bit, right? You are building cooling systems at Magnotherm, right? And so the question could be like, do you literally contribute to cooling the planet? But I think an easier way to ask this is just like, what is it that Magnotherm does?
Yeah, so we are a university spin-off. So originally the company comes from material science. We have a novel metal, which has a very specific effect that works in a way that when you magnetize this metal, it heats up. And when you demagnetize it, it cools down. So what you can do is you can take this heat from the material and transfer it to a fluid or a gas. And by doing this, we can actually build a cooling system. In parentheses, also we can build a heating system. So basically we are building heat pumps. But first applications are in refrigeration for supermarkets. And we can also take this technology to liquefy hydrogen at very low temperature levels. So, yeah. So thermodynamics, saying it very broadly.
Thermodynamics. Every engineer's dreaded topic in university. At least what I hear from my friends.
I was very bad at thermodynamics at university.
Well, now you're running a company based on thermodynamics, so you can't have done too badly. I'd like your founder's associate Juan once described Magnatherm to me as a materials company. And I would like to get your take on that citation, kind of like that. To what extent is that true?
Yeah, so that's the origin of the company. Not myself, I studied something different, but my co-founders, they come from material science, understanding the properties of those magic materials, the so-called magnetocaloric materials, understanding magnetism. This is all related to physics, to material science. And based on this material science, we have built now a company producing cooling systems. And also in terms of our competitors, for example, we are building cooling systems based on this deep understanding and knowledge of the materials. And that's why the core identity and origin is in the materials. And this is also where a lot of our IP is lying at the moment. And this is where we want to build the company around this interconnection between the fundamental effect and the mechanical and electrical cooling system that you can build upon this.
Yeah. Could you maybe like briefly explain to me, how does the whole supply chain work for you? So like, where do you get the metals from? And like, are they rare materials? Are they rare metals? Or like, are they available in abundance? You know, like what's the picture here?
So the two core components of our system is one, a permanent magnet for, let's say, supermarket units. It could be also a superconducting magnet for the hydrogen liquefaction, but I will stick with the permanent magnet for now. And the other core component is this active material. And both of them are magnetic materials, and the permanent magnet are neodymium iron boron magnets. So those are high-performance materials, which are also used in electric vehicles and smartphones, in windmills, and so on. This is actually an overlooked topic from politics and also from investors and in the startup scene. We need those critical materials. And what we do is we use also fresh materials. So the elements, they are mined from China mostly. But what we can do is, and this is our approach to make it more sustainable, we actually can reuse materials from old wind turbines or from old electric vehicles or from MRI scanners. So we can take this material and very easily reuse or recycle it. And the permanent magnet, as already the name states it, is working indefinitely long, so you can also in 1,000 years, if you treat it nicely, then you can directly reuse it. So we have here a chance to actually build a true circular economy with the permanent magnets, and that's very much needed if you want to be, let's say, independent from those regions in the future as a European ecosystem. And then for the magnetocaloric materials, there are different kinds of magnetocaloric materials that you can use. What we are trying to use next is an alloy which consists of mainly iron, so that's very abundant or cheap, and silicon, which is also abundant and cheap. And then we use like 8% more or less of this free rare earth. So rare earths is a historical name doesn't mean that all of those metals are actually rare. So we are using lanthanum or cerium. And those two, they're also very abundant and cheap because, first of all, they are the biggest chunk of this rare earth basket that you mine. But also, there's no application at the moment, or very few applications where this those materials are used. And sorry, in the future, and this is where another startup is working on, we can take a completely rare earth free material based on iron and phosphorus.
All right. I was considering right now to dive deeper into your supply chain, but I think that's not the goal today, because I have two goals actually, because you're running the commercials of Magnotherm, right? So I kind of want to talk to you about the commercialization or the whole go-to-market process in a deep tech company. And that's something that I would be actually really interested in, because I mean, it's one thing to have the innovation, right? But then for me as a business person, it's interesting how can I actually add value to someone who is definitely smarter than I am and has engineered something, you know, amazing. So let's see. I'd like to get your take on that. And my first question actually would be, because you mentioned that there are different applications for your product, right? And how did you decide initially, like which sector or which application you're going to focus on in your go-to-market?
So for us, we have some technical constraints and also, of course, some, let's say, customer constraints. We always have to balance out those two sides of the metal. So the question always was, what can we build easily and quickly? And also, what can we build with this that interests people? So we had like a period of 2 years where we have talked to anyone in the cooling sector who is doing something with refrigeration, always trying to, let's say, find out how big is the actual need and what is the actual problem that they're talking to us. And is there also, let's say, monetary interest in as well. So we've started out with looking at supermarket units in the beginning, because in terms of the temperature span and in terms of the cooling capacity, and also in terms of the just the general temperature area that we are working in, this is easy for us to achieve, because we are already working at around room temperature and not at very low temperature areas, but also it is not that much of a high cooling power that they need. So the systems can be fairly small, and that's easier for us than building directly something in the megawatts. And then we actually get a lot of inbound requests from different companies, especially supermarkets. And after this 2 years, we've actually gone back to the supermarkets, because that's where current regulation is also putting a lot of pressure on them. So the situation is that current technology, cooling technology, is based on refrigerant gases, and they used to be HCFCs or other chemicals, so very climate damaging. And we are going back to the original ones we used 150 years ago, and they are so-called natural refrigerants, but they are explosive or toxic, and they cause some problems, especially for supermarkets. And yeah, from that, we have identified a very small niche for our first product where we can enter the market and then grow from there. And this is a very small cooling display for supermarkets, or a very large beverage cooler, like a double door fridge. And there we can offer them a product which saves them costs, but also makes maintenance easier than the current tech.
Yeah.
So it's always like looking at the customer, but also looking at your technology. What can you actually achieve in a reasonable amount of time? And it's always a little bit tricky to bring those two words together.
Yeah, but it makes sense. Well, it makes a lot of sense. Like looking at like, okay, where, in what conditions does my technology perform well, and how does it combine with like ease of engineering, or like where is it actually cost efficient to to scale kind of when you bring it into a product. You just mentioned the, you know, cost efficiencies that your product brings to your buyers. Could you actually like give me a brief rundown of like what does your product do better now compared to existing alternatives? So what is it that, you know, that makes people interested in what you're doing, and how do you generate this inbound? So what is it that makes you unique?
So for B2B, it's always quite easy if you can reduce overall costs of the existing solution, then you're in basically. So for us, this means reducing the energy bill. So when you look at supermarkets, roughly 50% of the energy that they use goes into the refrigeration because they're running 24/7, and also they're not, let's say, optimized too much for some supermarkets. And we have the opportunity with our technology to reduce their energy bill by 30% with our higher energy efficiency. And that's like the biggest problem that we are solving for them. But also, going a little bit more into detail again on the refrigerants, we have a metal instead of a gas, so there's zero direct global warming potential. So the refrigerant, also when you dispose the units, they cannot leak into the atmosphere. So it's very easy to reduce emissions on that end. And then also, again, we have a metal and we transfer the heat onto water or water mixture. So it's very safe and easy to maintain. So you can use or you can have less qualified personnel to maintain the systems, saving costs also on this end and increasing the maintenance availability, because when you have a very complex cooling system based on CO2, they are pressurized up to 120 bars, which is insanely high. And maintaining those, you need very technically, sophisticatedly skilled people to find the problem and actually then find a solution for it. So for us, with our system, it gets a lot easier and cheaper.
Yeah. So that's one of those like win-win-win situations, basically. Climate wins, customer wins, and well, you build the product, so you win kind of as well, hopefully as well. I'd like to know, or like go through your customer inbound process, or like you go to market a bit. So because you said you receive a lot of inbound on your website, for example. So how do you, as a deep tech company, you know, go through an initial prospecting call? You know, what are the kind of criteria that you apply to inbound to see, okay, is this a fit for us right now or is it not? You know, what are the key points that you try to identify?
Yeah, so it's a very good question because we're constantly trying to improve this. But what we've done so far, we have looked at the potential partner if they, technically speaking, are in our range. So is it the temperature span that we can achieve easily? So, for example, which is super interesting, is going down to minus 100 degrees C, because current tech is actually not very good there. But it's very difficult for us to achieve minus 100 degrees C. So we want to stay between minus 5 and plus 50, more or less. So does this application that they are looking, or does the current application that they're doing fit to our temperature span, but also to the cooling capacity? So we cannot refrigerate or temperature control big logistics, like Amazon logistic warehouses. That's way too much cooling capacity for us. So is it small enough for us to actually go into the data application? And then as well, what are the costs at the moment? Is this a product that is interesting to us because they produce a lot of costs along the product lifetime? So for example, a household refrigerator is not very interesting to us because it's all about the invest costs and nobody knows how much electricity is used during the year for the household refrigerator. So efficiency gains there is not a unique selling proposition. So taking all of this into account and also including, let's say, is this monetarily speaking the right partner for us? So can they actually provide us funds, or are they able to put down money as a pre-order for our products? And this is basically the perfect fit then, someone who understands the problem and is willing to already engage in quite early phase with us, although our product is not finalized yet.
Yeah. Could you actually like sketch out the kind of buying process for me a bit? So like, with like, what kind of mentality do companies approach you, right? Like, you're quite a young venture. I mean, you've raised venture capital, right? So you're funded and you have like, well, good stats on paper, right? But you're also quite early in your commercialization process, right? So how does this, you know, initial partnership kind of look like? What kind of mentality do people bring to the table? What is the setup here?
So in the very early days, we have actually sold workshops to also test if they are willing to put down money about the technology, because it's a quite unique technology and there's not a lot of knowledge out there and experts out there. So that was the very beginning, and also services. We have designed some magnetic products also not directly related to what we're doing. And then we have really focused on building a product that a wide set of people or companies would buy. And this is the double door fridge. So they would engage with us doing a pilot project with this double door fridge. And along the way, we are already offering a small fridge, which is a beverage cooler. So they can rent or buy this, we call it Polaris. So it's a small version of the final product, which is not fulfilling all the criteria that current customers have, but it's already building up trust and showing that we are able to get to the final product. And this is basically what we have been doing now for this year and last year, offering and selling and producing those beverage coolers, and showing them at different events and renting them out for not only customers, but also for our suppliers to help them showcase, for example, a 3D printing company, what they can do with their technologies. So ideally now they are putting down pre-orders and say, I want to buy 100 of those double door fridges as soon as they're ready. And this is what we are preparing at the moment. And this is how companies would engage with us, doing a pilot project and then putting down money for pre-orders.
Okay, got it. So that you have the capital to well produce for those orders. So like, I would be interested if you look at like the people you've engaged with, the different customers. Obviously, no need to drop names here. But like, how do you, let's say, differentiate between good customers and bad customers? So if you were to talk to another founder of another like deep tech startup, you know, like, what are good customers? What are bad customers for a deep tech startup like you?
In this early phase, for us, a good customer would be also a friendly customer, understanding our problems, understanding the challenges that a deep tech startup faces during this early phase, and helping also on the development and giving feedback, and not only insisting on, let's say, the hard criteria, is this already at this energy efficiency level that I needed to be in order to place orders, but really understanding the journey. And this is what we are trying to show to our partners, where we've come from in terms of, for example, energy efficiency, and where we are at the moment. Although in absolute terms, we are not there yet, but in relative terms, we are on a very good track. And those are good customers who have this flexibility or this mindset, and not only look at their specifications list and say, this has to be checked, this has to be checked, otherwise we are not talking. Yeah. So that's always very nice to have.
Yeah. How do you deal? I mean, it's easy to deal with a good customer if they're friendly, you know, and they bring that partnership mindset to the table. How do you deal with a bad customer that, as you just define them, you know what I mean? Like what does the process there look like?
I mean,
because they might also turn into a good customer in the future, right? Like, exactly. You don't want to burn any bridges here.
Exactly. So a bad customer, of course, this is a little bit black and white, and this is only time dependent for this period. So as you said, they can also turn into good customers in the future, and maybe they're even the better customers at the end of the day, because it's a very clear decision-making process for them. If we reach those criteria, then they would buy maybe a lot more than the early friendly customer. So what we do is we keep them updated and say, thanks for your feedback, and very exciting to see your general interest. And we're working on those topics. And as soon as we reach them, those milestones, we will come back to you. And we, of course, want to keep them informed about what's happening here at our company and not lose this contact. And this is basically also what we are professionalizing right now, this customer or potential customer relationship management and this business development side of the company.
I'd be interested. I already mentioned my friend Juan, who works with you, and like he also told me that your buyer group, especially like the procurement people from my big companies, they seem to know each other a lot. It seems that they're running tight networks basically, and so that also generates inbound for you. But I would like to know from you basically, like, what is your experience with that? You know, like, how does this tightly knit network among your buyer persona basically affect the sales process?
Yeah, it's quite interesting, because you have to be careful in your communications, of course. It has to be consistent. If they all talk to each other, then you don't want to tell a different story to person A and then to person B, and when they talk to each other, they are both confused. So that's very important. But also, this is a large opportunity if you manage to win over one of those people in this closely knit network. Then this means you will have several doors opened at the same time. But for that, you need to build up trust, and you need to be legit. And this is something that we are really aware of and trying to do, that we are not over-promising too much and delivering on our promises, especially with our technology, which has some baggage and some history, because it already was promised 10 or 15 years ago that it would be soon commercialized, and it didn't happen for some reasons.
Sounds like fusion. Like fusion. No, but
so that's very important, to make sure that you set the right expectations, but still excite them. And that's, I think, a close line.
Yeah. Do you have an example of a, like, or a story or so where, you know, like, careful or like honest engagement with a customer has like built trust for sure?
Yeah, we have this one company which are very legit people in the refrigeration space, and they have been monitoring this technology for a long time. They already engaged in this technology previously, and now they are more cautious because they want to see that it can actually be done now. And what we do is we keep them closely informed about our advancements, and we actually show this improvement trajectory to them. Like, this is what we currently have, being very transparent. Those are the things that we have achieved, but those are the things we have not achieved yet. And then a couple months later, showing them, now we actually have achieved a couple of those things on the to-do list. And now we are going to address the next ones, issues. And this, I think, I hope, builds up enough trust to those partners that they at some point would then also go public with us and say, all right, they convinced us, we're totally believing in this technology, but also in this company, and give us some slack, cut us some slack, and
But interesting. It sounds a bit like investor relations, you know, sending over regular updates basically and having, I don't know, like check-in calls, so to speak, to give people like an overview of what has happened in the past and what kind of milestones you have achieved. Is that what I can imagine it to look like, that you have these kind of regular check-ins with these people, or how does it work?
Exactly. Same with investors. They want to see, are you able to get to the next level? Are you able to hit the next milestone? Similar to our potential customers and partners, is this a company, is this a technology where we should put more effort, more money, more time into? And this is exactly the same procedure. We schedule regular meetings, but also we, on a technical level, we are engaging with them, and we have this Polaris beverage cooler, and we are further improving it. So we would send over the latest version to them so they can see for themselves what's the current energy efficiency, what is the current usability, but also noise level, and giving them, let's say, not always only story, but also hard facts and a physical device that they can see our advancements.
Yeah. Before this interview, or like in the beginning of the interview, you said that, you know, you're quite happy about like where Magnetherm is going, and that like it really gives you confidence to see that you have already like taken some steps and built a good company so far. But before the interview, I also asked you about like not only what has been your biggest aha moment, but what has been your biggest oh fuck moment. Yeah. And you told me that there was a time when you were close to running out of money, right? So I would be interested in also talking about the times that when things were not too rosy. I mean, now you've raised a like substantial round, I would say. Like you've raised, I think, 7 to 8 million euros, basically. So money's probably like for now, at least, not a problem. But like, how did you feel at the time when, you know, things were not as good?
I mean, my takeaway is that money is always a problem because you don't want to be in a situation where you have to cut significant costs or lay off people or not pay yourself your salary for a couple of months. So this is actually what happened. So we, as a founding team, we had to, live from our savings for quite some time because we were coming very closely to zero money in the cash, in the bank account. And the banks also wouldn't give us some credit line. So that was a very interesting experience. Luckily, we were able to get money in from one of the grants at the right time, but this was also delayed. And basically what happened is we completely underestimated the time and effort we have to put in to raise the seed round. In the end, it all worked out, and we actually oversubscribed a lot and see further interest also at the moment, although the round is already closed. But at that time, that's when the Russian invasion in Ukraine happened. That's when the turnaround on the interest rates happened. That's when the chip crisis happened. Also some COVID aftermath still happening, supply chain crisis and so on. So that was a very difficult time for us to raise money. And it took us more than a year to actually get the money in the bank. And during that time, we had to rely on other sources of money. And so the takeaway is you should always keep an eye on the bank account and try to get in as much money as possible to absolutely de-risk this insolvency problem, because there's no way out. If you're running out of money, then it's over, and it's very difficult to rehabilitate from that.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. Like, always be raising, or like keep an eye on the bank account, basically. Because you don't know what kind of perfect storm is brewing up, as you just described, you know, it'd be like the interest rate scenario, the Russian invasion and so on and so forth, right? Like a lot of factors that might suddenly turn against you. I'd like to know, like, what kind of steps and abilities from your perspective were crucial to like go through that scenario or through that situation? And what kind of steps do you think were crucial to like save you, you know, like what is it that saved you in the end?
factoring a lot of buffer. So also now our financial planning has different scenarios on how much revenue are we going to make? When is the next investor coming in? When are we getting more grants in? And really factoring a lot of buffer, but also closely monitoring the financial situation and monitoring the costs and the money that is going out of the company. So that it cannot be overstated that liquidity is the most important KPI in an early stage of a startup company.
Yeah, cash is king. Otherwise it's over. I would be interested, like, as a detox, where were your biggest expenses? I mean, like, I guess they relate to, you know, just like scientific research, like product engineering, whatever you might call it. Like, would be interesting to get your perspective here, but also like how they compare to today, where there's some things that you basically completely cut back and that you're not missing today, or, you know, like what does that look like?
So our biggest expense always has been and still is the personnel. So for us, deep tech means that we need a lot of expertise. So you have to have a wide range of expertise, but also you need to have in-depth knowledge in those different areas. So that's the reason why for a seed company, we acquired a lot of people already with 40 people, and 2/3 or 60% of them are on the technical side. And of course, you also need highly skilled people. So we have a couple of PhDs also in the team. And this means the salary is also naturally a little bit higher. And really getting in the right people at the right time, that's very important. But also, of course, looking at hardware, we have quite high expenses on prototyping. So we need different machines. So we do a lot of 3D printing. We have our own CNC mill, turning machine, and so on and so on. And also building this unique new machine requires customized components for us. So for example, the magnet, it's a very special design of magnetic material. And in low quantities, the prices are quite high, obviously. And this is also quite a big expense. But in relation to the personnel costs, it's not the highest expense.
Yeah, no, I get it. I'm actually curious, like, as you just said now, like, you have like custom-made components and so on that you need to manufacture yourself. What will it look like once you go into like a serial production process? Like, are you gonna like scale your own manufacturing? Are you like looking to like for like manufacturing partners? Like, what does that process look like for a deep tech startup? Like, I'm really asking out of curiosity spontaneously right now, because I don't know what might be the, if there is like a path of choice at all, like the best practice, you know, kind of example.
I guess there are different scenarios. Like always, there is a scenario where ideally we would have everything in-house, because we have this self-understanding that if we do it ourselves, we are quicker and maybe even better than working with partners. But of course, we are restricted in terms of capital, so we cannot build up like a perfect production line at the moment. So over time, this might change. But for the time being, we are relying on suppliers and partners to co-develop this technology with us. And also in terms of capital costs, it's quite attractive to look at the business model where we only supply our customers with a core component, which is easy to produce, cheap to produce, and scalable. So we have also this scenario where we are really disintegrating most of the value chain, and we only focus on the so-called active magnetic regenerator, which is the centerpiece of this technology. And this is where we also have most of the IP and the know-how. And this is also a factor. There are companies out there who can produce way cheaper and better than us currently. And it makes sense to focus on your strengths and not to in-source everything.
Yeah. Okay, interesting to hear from you as a non-engineer overall, like how to think about that process. We were talking about money before and how it's kind of important to run a business, and especially run a business that is still in a heavy research phase. Usually, if you think about raising money, you know, that's already hard. You know, if you're a startup raising funds from VCs or invest in general, that's hard. Then fundraising as a software startup is hard, but easier than raising funds than compared to if you're a deep tech startup, right? So like fundraising as deep tech startup is harder. And then there's a scenario where you're a spin-off like you from a university, which is probably the hardest. That's like the overall, you know, public conception, I think, perception of the process. How do you see that? Would you agree with that kind of hierarchy? So raising as a software startup is the easiest, then deep tech spin-off from a university?
Yeah, I could agree with this. It's always about showing traction. And as a software company, it's much easier to get to a point where you have paying customers for an MVP, or where you have subscribers, or generally speaking, showing traction. And that's, I think, the difficult part for hardware companies. That's much more capital intensive and takes much more time and also expertise to get to some kind of MVP and to get to a point to show traction. And when you can show traction, I think then it's an easier scenario to raise money. I think also what you have to factor in is this technology risk. So as a deep tech company, you are working on a novel, it can also be software, by the way, but you're working on a novel technology. And as a hardware company, obviously, you have to also own and mitigate the risks on the hardware side. So this is what you have to show to potential investors, that you are able to first quantify the risks to some extent, but also that you have a plan how to manage and how to de-risk the technology in the future. And from my perspective, that's the big advantage with software, that you don't have to deal with all the technical eventualities, because that's where you can rely on AWS or other companies helping you on that.
Yeah. Could you maybe actually run me a bit through your own fundraising process? So you raised from two quite reputable investors in the climate space, I would say, Accenture and Revent. And I'd like to know what kind of proof points did they want to see to be convinced? What did their process with you look like, and how did you perceive the interaction? And also, I'd be happy to feel free to provide examples or stories from your interaction with other VCs or other investors.
Yeah, so sure, absolutely. So for us, I think what happened is that we have built up a relationship with, let's say, Accenture, for example. We've met Torben and IEA separately by coincidence on different events, and have had a quite good conversation and common understanding on how to build a company. And also I've come to them for advice and say, I'm in a very early stage. What do you think is necessary to get funding from investors like you? And then following up on this, and there was this point where they've visited us, and we've come to a point where we actually build up a team of 15 people, have rented our own space, have moved out of university. We were able to get more grants into the company and have equity free money to get to our MVP. And this ability to scale from a university team to an actual startup company, I think this was one of the proof points for them to trust in us as people. And also, of course, we have IP, we have a patent. And what I really liked also in the conversation with them is that they want to get to the bottom of the technology and are open to deep science conversations. And I think in deep tech and hardware, that's necessary in order to also understand our strategy and go to market journey. I think this was just a very good fit and very mutual understanding of how to do things.
You're kind of answering already a bit my next question, but I would like to know again from your perspective. I guess like those two were not the only investors that you talked to, right, or that you considered. But why did you pick them in the end, right? Like, it's one thing to get a yes from an investor, but investors also need to get a yes from founders, right? That they can put their money into a certain company. So what was maybe like your ideal investor, like that you had in mind when you went through the fundraising process, and what did you like about those two in the end?
So really having this mindset and this curiosity about the fundamental technology, and a lot of what we are doing on a daily basis builds upon the technical restrictions that we have, and figuring out what is the next step that we should take. Is it a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left? And dealing with investors and telling them what we are doing right now is much easier when they also have this curiosity about what are the restrictions of the technology. And that's basically one of the big factors how we have chosen our investors. Are they able to understand the technology, but also do they have a common view with us where to go next? And of course, we also wanted to have investors who have a very good credibility in the market. I think taking on the first investors is a very strong signaling to future investors. And that's where especially Exscientia and also Revent have a quite good reputation in the market. But aside from them, we also have the state of Hesse here from our region in the cap table. And they are also very good partners for us, because we have this conviction that we are coming from Darmstadt, from Frankfurt here, from this region. And this is where we want to build something up. And having those partners here, they are also unlocking future grant money or future partnerships within the region. And of course, we also have other investors still. So very interestingly, two strategic partners or investors, one coming from the room temperature refrigeration space, helping us also, let's say, how to build up a production. And then also we have a strategic investor on the hydrogen side, also introducing us to their network and also helping us on a technical level. And finishing this off, we also have a couple of business angels who have also domain expertise in marketing and logistics. So I would say we have the full range of potential investors that you could have. And of course, there are also some downsides. So communication is much more difficult when you have 14 people on the cap table than one person, maybe. I think this is an asset to us. And we've also turned down some investors where we saw that we don't see the world in the same way and have not a shared vision. I hope this answers your question.
No, it certainly does. I'd just slowly like to come to an end, actually, and just like to finish it off, I would like to ask you, you know, thinking about the conversations you have had with other investors, or maybe also other, like, you know, deep tech founders that you have been talking to, maybe, what's like the best advice that you have gotten on building your company? And it must not be, you know, the best advice, but, you know, useful advice in general.
I'm very much convinced that you should be very open-minded and friendly, whoever is talking to you. And I have so many examples where I've gone to an event and I was not very motivated, but I still went there. And then it turned out that there was super interesting because I met this one person. And I have another example where I talked to someone recently and I thought, okay, there's no, this is not getting me anywhere. But then he introduced me to another person, and this person turned out to be super valuable. And also, let's say, taking care of those connections and relationships, from my experience, this was always very helpful to get the investors, to get first customers, to also get the right employees. So having a big bubble, so to say, a big network, and taking care of the network, that's always favorable.
Yeah. Okay, cool. No, you never know what's waiting around the corner. So try to at least pave the way for that. I get that. No, Timur, very cool. Thank you so much for taking the time. And well, all the best for Magnetherm.
Thank you, Pascal. It was really cool speaking to you. And thanks again for your questions and taking me on this podcast.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.